Are we exposed? This is what every security team is wondering. But with vulnerabilities scattered across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos, the truth is out of reach, and attackers know it. There's a better way. Unify to defy risk with Tenable AI-powered exposure management. Tenable brings together all your security data and exposures in one unified view, giving you the attacker's map and revealing the critical paths and weaknesses they can exploit. Now your teams can prioritize intelligently, move decisively, and collaborate without friction. Tenable turns scattered work into a single proactive force. Instead of chasing noise, your team knows where to focus, gaining clarity, control, and speed to reduce cyber risk with confidence. Learn more at tenable.com. Tenable. Your exposure ends here.
Work moves fast. Every email, report, and proposal counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It's your one place to think, write, and finish. Grammarly's AI agents help you find natural phrasing, fine-tune tone, and confidently write wherever you work. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at Grammarly.com.
Giles Brown.
Let's talk.
When something happens inside Railtrack, a CEO shows his story for the first time. People think that a 47-year-long career in an office is boring, but it's not. It's been a roller coaster ride. Stuff happened. Credit crunches, wars, recessions, currency crisis, pandemics, takeovers, mergers, flotations, profit warnings, the lot. The past is a country worth visiting. I wanted to share my experiences. I have now told my story. That is what Gerald Corbett has said. I'm delighted to join and say that the man himself joins me live on the line now to tell us more about when something happens. Gerald, good morning to you, sir.
Yes, good morning. Good morning.
Yes, I mean, I just love that quote. People thinking because you've been chairman of, was it 12 companies, 11 companies on the board? And people think, oh.
I mean, if you add it all up, I've been a director of 13 public companies, of which seven I was chairman.
And not to mention that, if you like, as the kids would say, the side hustles, i.e. the MCC, for example.
Yes, that was my sort of Indian summer.
Right.
I did that at the end. You, it's a pro bono role, but it's extremely hard work and very difficult. But I enjoyed it.
I can imagine. But I mean, the office one, the perks must be quite nice as you look across that hallowed stretch of cricketing paradise.
Well, if you love cricket, which I do, yeah, although I'm not very good at it. If you love the game, it's a wonderful role. It really is. But it's extremely difficult.
Yes.
It's in the public eye.
Yeah.
And it's a members club, and things can go wrong. And I can bang on about it forever if you like, but you're asking the questions. I'll just give the answer.
I like it, but I'm not very good at it. That's my sporting and business stories, full stop. I like them, but I'm not very good at them at all. And I should imagine dealing with that particular club. A very good friend of mine goes to the MCC quite a lot. She's a lovely young lady called Caroline, and she says the members are always fascinating, got some great tales to tell, and luckily a lot of it is behind closed doors. So I think we'll quickly draw a veil over that one. However, let's talk about your early career, because I find it fascinating. I had the pleasure to walk in 1985. I went to the old Stock Exchange building and walked the floor as it was back then, open outcry and all that sort of thing. And your career does stem that whole period between the city as it was and the high tech world in which we know today.
That is absolutely right. I mean, when I began, faxes were a relatively new thing. There weren't mobile phones. There certainly weren't computers. Lunches in the city were sort of long affairs. Mm. And always ended up with a glass of port, and you'd sort of stagger off back to the office for an hour or so and then get onto the train to go home.
Halcyon days. So what was appealing for
well,
you
what
to get
did it? What
here?
Did it was yeah. What made the changes was Big Bang, of course.
Sure.
Because back in the day, back then, it was it was very sort of private school orientated, or if you hadn't been to a decent private school, you had to have been to a decent regiment in the army.
Yeah.
And of course, it was very Oxbridge, and your word was your bond, and you did business with people who you were at school with, or they were at similar schools, or you knew someone who knew them. It was that sort of world. And then Big Bang opened it all up, and the American and banks were allowed to come in, and the integrated houses were allowed to trade, and so on and so forth. And that made the city a much more meritocratic, more professional place. And it was a great reform, because the city then effectively boomed for about 25 years. And in the early part of this century, I mean, if you think back to the skyline, what happened there with Canary Wharf and all the rest of it, and London became arguably the most important financial centre in the world.
And it was quite an interesting movement when London moved from the city per se out to Canary Wharf. I mean, and people don't really think that much about it. But I mean, for those, you know, I was working with the LDDC at the time, which would be the early 90s, and they were sort of, it was just coming to an end then. But, you know, the first big houses were going out there. You know, the Reichman brothers had built, you know, Canary Wharf, and it really was a sea change, and also a culture change.
Yes, that's right. And people had to get into the office far earlier in the morning, and they had to stay far later at night. And lunch became a sort of Peter smoked salmon and a glass of fizzy water.
Yes, indeed. So, an awful looks at this. An awful lot of this looks at the rail track situation. So, explain for those who perhaps aren't up in their knowledge of the financial landscape and the business landscape, you know, where you were when you got the call to handle one of the most, because, you know, Britain, you know, is a nation of railways, great pride in our rail network. Trust me, I live in Spain. And, you know, to get a train from the Costa del Sol to anywhere can sometimes be a bit of a problem. So, you know, we tend to forget in the UK how wonderfully interconnected the rail network makes us. But of course, it had been under the thumb, quote unquote, of the unions. And, you know, since the dark days of union power in the 70s.
Well, it was nationalised in 1948, if you recall. Before that, it was what was known as the Big Four regional railways. And you're right. I mean, there's 20,000 miles of track. There's 3 million people a day go on it. It was a big thing. It was the last of the great Tory privatisations. Mrs. Thatcher hadn't wanted to do it. John Major wanted to do it initially a different way and keep the track and the stations and the infrastructure in the public sector and just privatize the train operators. But the way it was ultimately done was to actually privatize the whole lot and split the railway into 100 different parts and hold it together with these legal contracts. And that proved to be a big mistake because it made it a management nightmare. All the railway is an integrated, it's an engineering system. The track and the train and that interface is fundamental. You know, what happens to the track is a function of what trains are run over it, et cetera, et cetera. And when you split it up, it becomes run. And there's a reason why the railways around the world are integrated, and that is it. And I mean, at a stroke, instead of having everybody working together to optimize the train performance, you had people arguing with each other with these adversarial contracts. We had 300 people sitting in an office allocating the causes of train delays between the train operators, the maintenance contractors, and the owner of the infrastructure rail track. So it's one of those situations where if you were good at arguing your point, you did better than if you concentrated on running the trains properly.
I mean, how do you keep your? I mean, how does one keep one's eye on the ball without one's brain exploding? Would be the first question there.
Well, with great difficulty. But in the early days of privatization, there were a number of successes in spite of the way that it was done. The punctuality of the trains improved by some 30%. And the investment went up. We refurbished all 2,500 stations. And we made good progress on all the key safety measures. I mean, 1998 was the first year since 1902 when there was not a single passenger death on the railway. Mm. And people forget those early successes.
And then, but unfortunately, I mean, tragically, we have two, in 1999, 2000, there are two tragic accidents, Ladbroke Grove, of course, and Hatfield. How do
you don't ever remind me.
Well,
yeah.
Exactly, but, I mean, how do you, if when that phone goes off, or when the first reports start coming in, I mean, we talk about crisis management, don't we? But, I mean, when it's actually landing on your desk, on, you know, what are you, how do you deal with that? Because I know people say, oh, he's a faceless CEO, but you're not, you're a human being, and you have empathy, and so therefore it is an extremely, and thankfully most of us in the quote-unquote normal world will never have to deal with that responsibility, and the fact that people, if there's a butt going to stop and a finger to be pointed, invariably it gets pointed in your direction.
Yes, I wouldn't. I think everybody in their lives has tragedy and has problems, and there are disasters. And I mean, something every day, some things go well, some things don't go well. So everybody's used to handling adversity. But when you're heading a big public service and something goes badly wrong, and there's a train crash and people have died, you're right. It is truly terrible. And of course, people look to the leaders for a way, everybody's shocked. Everybody's wondering what it means for them, what it means for their company, whose fault is it, and there's great uncertainty and a sort of venting. But you know, the service has to continue to run. 3 million people go on the thing every day. You have to give leadership to your own team and the people in the company. And then, of course, there's all the people that are traveling on the trains. They want reassurance. There's the train operators, the contractors, the banks, the investors. It's an extremely busy, difficult period.
What was it like facing, say, the media at this point? You know, I talk as a member, you know, because I've been on, you know, I've been a journalist. You know, I've sat in on press conferences. I've sat in on.
Well, it's very difficult, yeah. but you know, there's a reason why you're paid a lot of money to do these jobs and everything, and that's when it's down to you to deal with it on. On Ladbroke Grove, which was the worst train crash for 20 years or something, 31 people died. It was ghastly. On the 9 o'clock news the day after the crash, there was myself, a survivor of the crash, and someone from the HSE. And you're sitting there in the studio being interviewed by John Sissons on the news, and the survivor tells his harrowing story. And then the HSE rather clinically sort of go through the safety record and everything. And of course, the lights are dimmed and there's these spotlights. And then it turns to you and you have to explain why the railway let everybody down.
Very difficult indeed. When did you leave Railtrack? When did you decide that you'd done all you could do at this point?
Well, it wasn't fun. At the end of the day, it wasn't my choice. I was chief executive for 3 years.
Right.
And the first 2 years, it went rather well with improvements in punctuality. We saved the Channel Tunnel rail link. The share price went up from £3.90, which is what it was when we floated, to £17. The safety record got better. We doubled investment, so on and so forth. And then there was the train crash.
Yeah.
Under BR, when it was nationalised, the railways effectively reported to a minister. And you, when there was a crash or something went wrong, you got political air cover. But in 1999, the government, very concerned that people would call for John Prescott's head, and they wanted to absolve him of all blame. It wasn't John Prescott's fault that the train went through the red light. Of course, it wasn't. But they were worried that he would get blamed for not having changed the structure and the fragmentation of the railway, and there was also a key safety thing that had been sitting there called train protection warning system, sitting on his desk, which had been there for 6 months. It wouldn't have actually made any difference at the end of the day, but they were very anxious to make sure that the railway got the blame. And of course, Thames Trains, which was the the train that drove through the red light. So small companies. There's no point in blaming the small companies. So it was us that bore the brunt of that. And we had an horrific weekend when the government briefed that we were going to be stripped of our safety responsibilities and that it was Railtrack's fault. And then the Sunday papers, the Mirror and whatever, called for my resignation, and it got very difficult. And there was a lot of anger, and we had bricks being thrown through signal box windows. We had our signalers being spat at in newsagents. It was deeply unpleasant. But then we got it all working together again, and we had a pretty good year, the year 2000. And I can remember going down to the Channel Tunnel railing when we broke through the tunnel, goes under the North Downs. John Prescott came to for that ceremony, and we travelled down together, and he said it was getting better and everything. And I can remember him saying, let's just hope and pray there isn't another one. I don't know what will happen. And, of course, there was another one. There was Hatfield. Four people died. It was a broken rail. That was clearly our fault, who was our maintenance contractor. And so I tendered my resignation. I thought that was the right thing to do, to accept the accountability. But then I got, in the next 24 hours, I got huge support from shareholders, from the train operators, from the Paddington Survivors Group, from Number 10. And my resignation was rejected. And I was asked to stay. And so we got stuck in. We started checking all the network to make sure there weren't any other rails in that condition. And it was a very busy period. And then the board asked me to leave. And I think they just felt that if I left, that, well, the chairman said to me, I said, why was I asked to stay on a month ago? Yeah. But now you're asking me to leave. And he said, without you here, there'll be no one to attack. They keep attacking us. And without you in here, we think it will stop. I said, I think you'll find it'll just get worse. Mm. He said, that's where we've got to, he said. And of course, you can't do the job without the support of the non-executive. So it was a sad ending. And then a year later, the thing was put into administration. And that was it. It was sad. I reflect back on it and the company and the people that work for it and the investors and let alone the people that all those trains that crashed. It was a difficult period.
How sanguine do you have to be when these
sanguine?
How do you just think? Well, it's part of the job, I suppose. It's part of the. You know, when you're asked to leave, and it would have been very, very different. You know, you could have just gone off and gone on gardening leave, or gone off and, you know, got your handicap, or watch the cricket, and but presumably there's a little voice inside you that goes, okay, so I'm going to take a couple of weeks off, come and dust myself down, and because you got sort of. I'll use rugby to parlance here, stuck back in rather than cricketing thing. So, but you didn't, you went to sort of encouraging small businesses and using and advising sort of startups.
That's not quite right. When you go for it, it turned out, and of course, if it's you that's asked to leave, and this may be the reason why I was asked to leave, if it's you that's asked to leave, you end up taking all the blame. And then you end up getting scapegoated. It's inevitable. It's what always happens. So it was a difficult period. But you have to put one foot in front of the other and get on and all of that. And then I became chairman of the Woolworths Group as we demerged from Kingfisher.
Right.
And then there was the court case because the government were desperate to get people from Railtrack into the dock. There's always a sort of political imperative to get the fat cat sort of thing. So I had to go through that. And then fortunately that was chucked out in a pre-trial hearing, which was a good moment. But that took 3 years. But I did get going again. And people forget that for 20 years prior to doing Railtrack, I've been finance director of three big companies. In fact, I was the longest serving finance director on the on the 100 group, which is the FTSE 100 group of finance directors.
Right.
So I had that behind me. It wasn't people when they thought about it could see that, of course, the broken rail at Hatfield wasn't directly attributable to me, and so on and so forth. And time is a great healer. And then I became chairman of SSL, which makes Durex and Scholl, and chairman of Britvic, which we floated. It was previously owned by a hotel company. And then MoneySupermarket.com and the mighty Betfair. And then Numis, which is a city company. And then my last job was Segro, which is the biggest property company in the country, which we took into the FTSE and ended up number 35. So, you know, there is, life goes on.
Yeah, I just like the mighty Betfair, because, well, you know, we're just down the road from Gibraltar, so we knew all about sort of the online.
Oh, yes, you would. We had an office there. Yeah.
Exactly. So that they were indeed mighty down there on the rock. It was quite good fun, but that's a story.
Well, it was interesting doing two internet companies. Money Supermarkets was a brilliant idea,
yeah,
of using the internet to price compare insurance, car insurance, and loans, and all the rest of it, and that changed that sort of world, and that was interesting. And then Betfair again was the use of the internet, which reduced the cost of gambling to punters with the exchange, and that was very interesting too. So, looking at the whole thing in the round, which is what I try to do in my book. I like to think I had a reasonable run.
Yeah. So why the book? Because I mean, did you think you want to get it off your chest? That it's an interesting read, but also, I mean, are there lessons? Do you think? I mean, everybody, you know, the best thing you can do is ask for somebody who's been there, done that, and literally worn the T-shirt or the MCC tie in your case. So yes. I mean, it's not a how-to, is it? It's not, because we are submerged under a virtual tsunami of be a million by this time next, you know, tomorrow books. You know, just follow my 5 steps to success. Is it just, again, it's obviously autobiographical, but there are also some, and without getting all American on you, is there some, you know, snapshots of an interesting time there as well?
Yes, well, there's a whole bunch of questions that you've asked there. I mean, why write it? I mean, first of all, it's the past is an interesting country to visit, and I would encourage everybody to do that, because when you're young and you go through various experiences, it's all quite quick and it's quite instant and you move on quite quickly, and it's only really when you look back on it and you see things through through a lens called the passage of time, and that's sort of cathartic and helpful, and that's cool. And then I wanted to share my experiences with other people, because, you know, a hell of a lot happened and it was a pretty busy time. And looking back on the whole 47 years, I mean, the advice, I retired when I was 71, into a different room now. But when people ask me, you know, what's your advice? What would you say to someone starting out on their career and all the rest of it? I always concentrate on three things. I just think there's three things you should do. You're not going to hit a 6 every ball. Not every putt's going to go in the hole. There's going to be moments when things are difficult. Every day that stuff goes right, stuff goes wrong. But the three things I hold to are: one, you must work hard as you possibly can, do as well as you possibly can. Arnold Palmer, or was it Gary Player, was right. The harder you work, the more luck you have. And there are very few successful people who don't work hard. So that's number one.
Yeah.
Number two is be a good colleague. You must treat other people fairly. You must be honest. You mustn't fiddle your expenses. You must be straightforward, easy to work with. You must always go the extra yard for the people. You must act in the interests of the company. Be a good bloke. Being a good colleague. There are very few people who succeed who aren't good colleagues. So that's number two. Now, if you work hard and you're a good colleague, then over the course of your career, there will be opportunities that will come along, both internally in the organization you're working for or externally. And the important thing is to take the opportunities as they come along. And some of them won't work, but some of them will. And I see a lot of people who don't take those opportunities. They end up stuck in one place, and they don't really have the kind of careers that maybe they would do if it had a go.
I suppose you're talking about sort of business, you know, integrity, sort of both morally, personally, and...
Yes, that's what I mean by being a good colleague. Yeah. You must tell the truth. People have to trust you. Your word is your bond. You must be kind to people. You must take the difficult decisions nicely and well. You must always act in the interests of the company. And these are things that actually are drummed into one from a pretty early age in your family, the schools you go to, and the university if you're lucky enough, and so on and so forth. So I do think that is right. Put bluntly, if you're a shit, you're not going to get very far.
Well, I think they should be the T-shirts, to be honest with you. I think we have a Monday morning. I think I'll use that in my promos. That'll get my production company happy. What are you hoping that people will learn? And what are you proudest of? I mean, it's not over yet, obviously, because you've been involved with MCC and the churches in St Albans and the High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, which presumably means you got to wear some pretty nifty outfits. I always think when people are High Sheriffs, I'm thinking Alan Rickman, obviously, in Robin Hood sort of thing.
I think it's good to do different things and to learn and to use what experience you've got and what skills you've got on different types of organizations and trying to do a bit of good rather than just growing the profits of a big company. I think that's cool. You meet totally different people and you've got a chance to make a difference. And I've been lucky that some of that's come my way.
So what was it like writing this, by the way?
Oh, I rather enjoyed it. I used a Mont Blanc pen.
That's nice. That's a Mont Blanc pen. I do have one myself. So
I thought you'd enjoy that. That's a throwback to the pre-Big Bang era of the city.
So
I wrote it out longhand, and then the person that helps us at home had been a secretary, so she typed it out. And everything, and that was how I did it. So it took a couple of years. I didn't do it all the time. I mean, some weeks I would go for weeks on end without writing anything. But I enjoyed it. It was good.
What are you hoping then? I mean, is it as you said before? Don't be a shit. Is that what we're looking for? Or it's just basically, as I said before, the book is a look at a colourful business career and an even more sort of colourful career in general.
So, what's the question?
Basically, the book is a look at both your life and also the front cover, the painting. Is that one of yours? Is it of you? Where's that come from?
Well, my wife's an artist, and she's extremely good at it. She's lots of exhibitions. She's hung in the summer exhibition at the Royal Academy, and that, believe it or not, is actually a picture of me sitting there reading the newspaper.
Sitting still, I think, which is the main
sitting
thing.
Sitting still, yes. Yes, that's right. Now, and that, of course, is the other thing. I mean, we've only talked about my career, but I think when you think about your life, then your partner, we've been married for 49 years, and your family and your local community, those are all terribly important things. In fact, they're in a way the most important part of the whole bit.
The book is called When Something Happens. I'm going to run out of time and crash the news, as the saying goes, in a minute. It is by Gerard Corbett, who we're speaking to today. Listeners, you can order it via our own virtual bookstore. You don't do social. Do you have a website? Do you do social media? Do you TikTok? Do you know that we're going to find you there?
No, I didn't do any of that, but I mean, I can just manage an email. But you can get the book through through Amazon or in a bookshop. Or
from our own virtual book. We have a virtual bookstore, and they click on the rather fine painting by your wife, you see, and a well-known South American river-based firm will deliver it to your door. It's amazing what they do. The book is called When Something Happens. It's by Gerard Corbett. Gerard, it's been an absolute pleasure, sir, to speak to you today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're a pro at running your life, at committing to your workout, at showing up every day. At Bombas, we're pros too. Pros at making socks. Our sport assortment has specialized socks for whatever sport you're committed to. Running, hiking, golf, Pilates, and so much more. Made with sweat-wicking yarns, blister-fighting details, and targeted arch support. Bombas Sport is pro-level socks from the pros of socks. For another pro, you. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code audio for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com and use code audio.
Thank you for calling the Bombas Comfort Line. Bombas make socks, slippers, tees, and underwear made with the highest quality materials. Press 1 for comfort, 2 for style, 3 for donation.
You chose style. Bombas has styles for whatever you enjoy. You can run in Bombas, lounge in Bombas, dress them up, dress them down, but always give back in Bombas. Because with every item purchased, another is donated. Bombas, comfort worth calling for. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code audio for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code audio.